Welcome. You are about to join the story of Lioness. Listen as host and author Diane Pendola brings you the Lioness Tale. Now it's time to come together and awaken to the liberating spirit that lives at the center of each of our lives. Here's Diane Pendola.
Hello. I am your host, Diane Pendola, and you are listening to The Lioness Tale, Awakening the Liberating Spirit. And I want to start the show today apologizing for last week to listeners who listened in to hear Dr. Susan Lauren. We had pre-recorded that show, and the station had put in the wrong tape. If you were disappointed in tuning in last week, please go to the show page, and you can listen to the show right now or at any time. Hopefully not right now, but it's well worth listening to. So please, please go and listen to it. I don't think you'll be disappointed. But today, I'm very privileged to welcome Dr. Howard Kornfeld to our program, and Dr. Kornfeld is one of the few medical doctors board certified in both chronic pain and addiction medicine. And on today's show, we will be speaking about the imprisoning effects of debilitating physical pain as well as the tyranny of addiction. So welcome, Howard.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
I'm so glad you're with us today. So before we begin our conversation, I always like to start with just a moment of centering. So for myself and for you, Howard, and for all of our listeners, just to take a moment to come into the present and come into breath, which is a great way to come into the present moment. And just take a deep breath, and as you do, begin to settle into yourself, relax, and open your heart to the spirit of this conversation today. So, once again, we are welcoming Dr. Howard Kornfeld to the show, and Dr. Kornfeld has created one of the most innovative practices in the field of addiction medicine and pain management. And as I said earlier, is one of the few certified physicians in addiction medicine who's also certified in pain medicine. And you have several programs, I think. You have Recovery Without Walls, Beating Your Addictions, which is oriented towards teens, and also a program oriented specifically to women's health. Would you like to just briefly talk about those and introduce yourself a little bit?
Sure, I'd be happy to. I should preface in that I was initially experienced and trained as an emergency physician, and I gradually evolved an interest in the pharmacology of medical conditions, particularly the psychopharmacology. And that led me into the study of addiction medicine and then pain medicine. So I'm coming at it from a background of a fairly broad experience with the kind of human suffering that occurs in emergencies. But as I've evolved, I've then adopted the care of patients who have more chronic conditions, but also from a day-to-day, they feel like they're in a crisis day-to-day. And often the chronic pain type of conditions paired with the often ineffective treatments that are initially offered patients accelerate this sense of crisis that patients are in.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I'm aware of that, and I think that is one of the beauties of the program that you offer, is that you're treating both chronic pain and addiction. The two are not always related, but often they are. And you do that with a great deal of sensitivity and compassion in your program.
Yeah, well, thank you very much. You know, I've always approached this from, you know, from a few principles of integrity of science, integrity of clear thinking, practicality, just the integrity of the basic physician credo of do no harm, you know, above all, do no harm to patients.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at the way our society has dealt with, let's say, the problem of opiate-type drugs, the problems of the drug laws, so to speak, in general, a lot of times there's been great harm done in the first instance without benefit to patients or our society.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll elaborate on that a little bit. Of course, people have always had painful conditions. Different medical systems have had different ways of dealing with pain and with discomfort, from different kinds of herbal medications in every culture. But in particular, in the old world, so to speak, as opposed to the new world, you know, the area of the world of Europe, the world of Asia, you know, certain herbal traditions existed in that part of the world, particularly around the opium poppy.
Mm-hmm.
And the opium poppy is a flower that creates a pod. And there are many, many kinds of poppies, dozens, but only one poppy that produces any significant quantity of morphine, which is a very unique molecule in the plant kingdom. There might be a little morphine found consistently in a few other related species, but the opium poppy, and the name of that species is Papaver somniverans. This is the only species that contains any appreciable amounts.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it appears that these evidence of cultivation of these poppies have been found throughout the Mediterranean and throughout Europe. Many times people think the poppy came from China, since we associate opium smoking with China.
Mm-hmm.
But in actuality, it started in the western part of the old world. And it's now found in archaeological remains that predate what we consider civilization.
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking about 6,000 BC in Switzerland, France, Spain. These poppies are... evidence for these poppies are found in the very old civilizations of antiquity.
So people have been seeking pain relief for a long time.
They have been.
Yeah.
They have been. And this was an era when, of course, agriculture was emerging. The human beings' skill at identifying plants was long advanced at that point, and it appears that one of the places that attention was paid to was this particular plant. And in Egypt, in the ancient Egyptian civilizations, there's very strong evidence of opium poppy being used. In Mesopotamia and in Greece, also very strong evidence. In fact, Hippocrates spent a lot of effort to explain the use of opium medically and dispel preoccupation with it, that it was only something that was significant for magical or ritual use, that he tried to really get the practical uses of it known and it was used in different states, different infections, different kinds of diarrhea or dysentery.
So it was used early on medically.
Yes, it was used early on medically, and as well as for pain. Then it was used, of course, in Rome. When Rome fell and the Middle Ages and the Dark Ages descended, there seems to have been a paucity of evidence for it being used in Europe, but a resurgence of its use in the Islamic world, and it gradually traveled east towards China, and it was a big part of Islamic medicine. Then later on in the 1500s, it seemed to drift back to Europe, and then it became a big part of, let's say, English medicine in Shakespearean time. It began to be appreciated as a very valuable remedy. And only the beginning hints of an addictive side of it was emerging in writings at that time. Now, if we somewhat fast forward into the 1800s, we have a different picture emerging of a great interest in opium in Western Europe, as well as the United States, and as well as a intensification of its use in the Far East. But it was just like it is now, a political entity. It back then was a political entity, in that what happened was the British took control over parts of India that were opium growing and grew very high quality opium. And at the same time, the British were undergoing an industrial revolution, as were all the countries in Europe. And what they really were looking for was tea, was caffeine-containing tea from China. They loved it. And it became part of British culture, tea time and whatnot. Now, at that time, there was not the ready availability in Europe of Starbucks and coffee everywhere. Coffee was a plant that came from parts of Africa, and it hadn't really caught on in Europe. So the Europeans, and the British in particular, wanted to get tea, but only China grew the tea. And China was very, they priced the tea, you know, very high because it was one of their valuable products. And in order to pay for bringing tea from China to England, the British discovered that they could sell more and more opium to the Chinese, the opium that they took control of in India. And they really didn't have control of China at this point. China was still a formidable both trading partner, but also adversary for them. And they kept up the trade in opium. Now, what happened in China is that what had been a low-level consumption of opium, both orally, because opium was used orally, meaning it was swallowed in terms of some sort of tinctures or some sort of pellets or whatnot, but the Chinese and around Asia, the smoking of opium caught on. Now, that's a fascinating story. Why did people start all of a sudden smoking something that they were ingesting for many centuries? Well, the Native Americans smoked things, and so when the Europeans came to America, by the 1500s, they were bringing back pipes and smoking implements, which up to that point had not been known or used in the old world.
Okay.
And so
I need to interrupt you here for a second.
Sure.
Because we're going to need to go to break.
Sure.
Yeah, but when we come back, we can bring this to the current concern with opiate use.
Great.
Yeah, great. Thanks. Okay, we're going to break now. Hello, this is Diane Pendola, your host for The Lioness Tale, Awakening the Liberating Spirit. And today we are most privileged to have Dr. Howard Kornfeld with us, who is really an expert in opiate use, pain, opiates for pain management, and also the challenges of addiction that often come with needing to deal with pain. So we pick up the conversation where we left off.
Okay, so we'll just summarize a couple things. So the smoking of opium became very prevalent in China, and the British discovered they could sell more and more opium. The emperor of China and the powers that be there did not like what they saw as a growing addiction to opium. So two wars were fought, the opium wars of the mid to late 1800s. And I only brought that up because I wanted to demonstrate how opium was intertwined with the political and economic reality of the 1800s.
Mm-hmm.
The reality that ensued was that opium became more and more prevalent in Europe, the use of opium, mainly oral, mainly ingested, and in the United States. This became part of the so-called patent medicines, things that were sold out of the back of covered wagons, and more people actually became opiate-dependent in America and in Europe. At the same time, alcohol was becoming a problem, and there were growing forces for the prohibition of alcohol and the regulation of opium. At the same time, the needle was invented, the hypodermic syringe and needle, and opium was processed so that the actual pure essence of morphine was pulled out of there. And by the middle to late 1800s, then hypodermic morphine was available, and that also started to become an addiction problem.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you get to the turn of the century, the first decade of the 20th century, 1900 to 1910, and what do you have is you have an epidemic of injecting morphine. Then you have Bayer Pharmaceuticals from Germany that invented heroin as an improved morphine. That turned out to be much more desirable for injecting users. And we have the birth of the heroin epidemic. And society's response to this was to crack down, to have the iron door shut tightly on the use of opiates. And although technically opiates were medically allowed throughout most of the 20th century, throughout most of the 1900s, in reality, physicians became afraid to use morphine and became afraid to use the drugs that emerged as relatives of morphine, even though they were very effective pain relievers. And except for very acute pain from an injury or surgery, physicians became very, very hesitant to use opiates to treat pain, and much of chronic pain was untreated or undertreated.
Because of this fear of addiction.
Precisely, and because of the government's taking control of the regulation, but in a very punitive way, where if a person became an addict, they were no longer considered a member of society. You know, they were considered a sociopath or a criminal, and they were imprisoned, and even special hospitals were developed that were eventually called narcotic farms in Lexington, Kentucky, and Fort Worth, Texas, which were like penitentiaries, but there was a medical treatment aspect, and it was actually better to be there than in some of the state penitentiaries if you were a serious opiate or heroin addict. In
but
terms,
there
of,
was some rehabilitative context to it.
Right. In fact, they ended up housing a lot of the good jazz musicians of New York, but in the narcotic farm, they enjoyed the people who ran it realized these were very talented people, and they regularly let them play and give concerts and whatnot.
Well, in some ways, it doesn't sound like the situation's all that different today. I mean, we still make addicts criminals. We still lock them up in prisons or send them to rehab. There still seems to be some fear from physicians in prescribing opiates. Is that true?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And things have started to change. The pendulum does swing in different ways. For example, there was awareness of the problems of people who were dying. This was popularized by Elizabeth Kubler-Ross in the 1960s. And as part of that movement of caring about people who were dying, it dawned upon clinicians as well as regulators that it was inhumane to deny opiates to people who were in severe pain, who were actually dying, as the addictive problem was not going to be a factor. And that gradually developed by the 1980s into the realization that there are people who have chronic severe pain who are not dying of cancer, but in a sense whose life is dying because of incapacitation from the pain, and that it became acceptable also in limited ways for physicians to prescribe opiates over a long term to patients such as these. And these opiates would be types of morphine and the use of longer-acting drugs like long-acting morphine and long-acting oxycodone, which is known as OxyContin, by brand name, or even medicine like methadone, which is originally developed for heroin addiction, it turns out is a very good long-term
pain reliever.
Mm-hmm. Now, at the same time this was going on, research was developing about opiate kind of drugs. In fact, when the metal gate clamped down on the use of opiates by physicians in the early part of the 20th century, the National Institute of Health and other pharmaceutical companies did initiate research into finding a less addictive or non-addicting type of morphine. Mm-hmm. And although they created a lot of candidates, there were problems with all the different drugs that were invented, but a very promising drug emerged in the 1970s called buprenorphine.
I know you've pioneered the use of buprenorphine.
I have been somewhat of a pioneer here in California and in the United States, because for some reason, even though this drug stood head and shoulders above the other opiates, and we've known about it for at least 30 years, it's been very, very slow to penetrate into clinical practice and into widespread knowledge about how to use it. There's no one explanation for why it's been slow. It has been less slow in Europe than the United States. In the United States, it was actually approved as a drug in the early 1980s, and it's still approved and available as an injection drug. The name of it is called Buprenex, capital B-U-P-R-E-N-E-X. And for anyone who needs a spelling of buprenorphine, I'll just do it quickly. It's B-U-P-R-E-N-O-R-P-H-I-N-E. Kind of a long name, but one you can get used to after a little practice. And this was the only available form of buprenorphine for 24 years or so in the United States. And it was not used very often, but the company who developed it, a company from England, kept it on the market to their credit. And then the same company worked in France to develop this drug as a treatment for addiction in the 1990s. It became evident early on that it was, in addition to a very good pain medicine, it was a very useful drug for managing opiate addiction, particularly heroin addiction or addiction to other opiate kind of pills.
So just like methadone was kind of linked originally with detoxing people from heroin, a lot of people, I think, aren't aware that methadone is also a very good pain reliever in itself and is not always connected with detoxing. That's true with buprenorphine also, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And there's different explanations for why this drug would have been slow to be adopted. One is that, of course, chronic pain patients and people with addiction are not necessarily that influential in making changes and making treatments available. The other explanation is there was no clear-cut profit to be made by a drug company unless very special circumstances were developed, which they eventually were, which was a so-called orphan drug law in the United States. And there's a general fear, particularly in our own United States, in our own kind of war on drugs culture, about introducing a new drug to treat addiction.
Mm-hmm.
There's a sense that addiction or pain should be treated without drugs, or simply people should figure out a way to transcend the need for drugs.
That's certainly not your position, is it?
No.
Because one of the reasons I did invite you on my show, just to kind of backtrack a little, the book, The Lioness Tale, speaks to the reality that human beings experience imprisonment in many ways, and for some, that imprisonment is chronic pain and disability. And it's a way that people often feel like their lives are lived out in the cage of a tormented body. And so to make opiates available to those people, just like it was a kind of a revolution in hospice care and care for the dying, that it's inhumane to deny something that's going to really help people with their pain to the dying, that's true for the living as well.
Absolutely. And the drugs that are available, that many doctors have felt were more available to them, often increased pain.
Mm-hmm.
For example, a very common prescription for people who are in pain who can't sleep, let's say, would be a sleeping pill, or would be a sedative drug like Valium or Xanax. And given in the wrong way, these could easily amplify the pain.
Uh-huh.
Also, the wrong kind of opiate drugs, let's say a drug that is popularly known as Vicodin, let's say, which contains something called hydrocodone, which is a very short-acting opiate. Given over time, that drug could increase pain because it wears off so quickly that it creates a roller coaster for the patient.
Mm-hmm.
And it was often prescribed because doctors felt they wouldn't be criticized if they prescribed this drug, but they would be criticized if they prescribed a drug like long-acting morphine or methadone or OxyContin. And so there's so much less than excellent standard of care in the area of pain management and addiction.
Yes.
For example,
and we need to go, I'd like to come back to that. We're going to need to go to break, but
sure.
I just want to comment that I do think you mentioned in a conversation that as much as medication is used in hospital care and medical care, there's very, very little instruction in medical school on really the use of medication for alleviating pain. So maybe we'll break with that and you can come back and we'll continue this part of the conversation. Okay?
Okay, great.
Great, thanks.
To love, serve, and remember. To love.
are listening to The Lioness Tale, Awakening the Liberating Spirit, with your host, Diane Pendola. If you would like to contact Diane, please send an email to thelionesstale@gmail.com. Again, that's thelionesstale@gmail.com. Now back to our program.
Hello, welcome back to The Lioness Tale, Awakening the Liberating Spirit. I'm your host, Diane Pendola, and today we are speaking with Dr. Howard Kornfeld. And we were just mentioning, Howard, about, I had mentioned before we went to break that there's just not a lot of education, even in medical school, about the use of opiates and medication for alleviating pain.
There is not very much, even though most medical schools and medical centers have a pain clinic right now and are doing much better work than they did in the past. When I interview students about how many hours of lecture they've had on addiction, on pain, it's quite limited. And I think there's a long way to go there. You know, if a patient has a heart condition, then and they show up at a hospital, as a society, we've led them to expect that they're going to get the best care available. Mm-hmm. You know, the standard of care. They're not going to be deprived of a certain major beneficial treatment. But in the area of addiction and chronic pain, there's been a unconscious agreement, let's say, up until recently, that this was somewhat perhaps their fault, you know? Mm-hmm. Or it's not a condition that we really are required to do anything about, you know? Mm-hmm. Maybe we can do something, but the person shouldn't expect real relief necessarily unless they find it themselves in some way. And so if a person gets less than standard care in the area of chronic pain, in the area of addictions, people have come to accept that, well, this is their fate because, you know, they didn't really deserve anything more than what they received. And so I'm trying to change that in my own medical community and in the influence that I can have on my students and patients, that these are conditions that there are evidence-based treatments for, that opiates can be used in a multidisciplinary program. In our work, when we use an opiate drug for pain, we like to use a sensible blend of medications that may address the situation so that we're not totally relying on the opiate, but there are very good medications that can treat, for example, nerve types of pain. Mm-hmm. Which are not always well managed with opiates. Mm-hmm. I think as a society, we're rediscovering that cannabis, you know, can be a component of medical treatment. That's another area that we're just starting to...
The place we've emphasized the war on drugs rather
right.
than the war on pain.
Precisely. And it turns out that As opium use was growing in the 19th century, the knowledge of cannabis was also growing, but it was cut short by different cultural and legal factors. Mm-hmm. Then, we need to deal with the psychology of pain. We need to deal with the spiritual emptiness that is associated with either addiction or chronic pain.
We really need to treat the whole person.
Precisely.
Body, mind, soul. Now, I know that you do that on several fronts. I know that you teach at medical centers, that you teach residents often in this area, and plus you have your program in Mill Valley. So maybe you could tell us a little bit about your program if there's listeners who really are in need of what you have to offer.
Well, we've called our program Recovery Without Walls, and it is a medical practice. And one interesting thing about addiction is, again, addiction was segregated out of the regular medical care system, so that there are wonderful places, so-called 28-day type residential programs that have helped many, many people. But one of the weaknesses of those programs is they're by and large outside of the medical system, not directed by physicians. Medical care is sometimes an afterthought. There is a belief system that that wonderful program, which is Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, can maybe do more for people as a psychosocial program when people actually have severe medical needs. Mm-hmm. And there are, although the founders of Alcoholics Anonymous actually were either physicians or people who reached out to physicians, a misinterpretation of the philosophy of Alcoholics Anonymous led many people for many decades to reject the role of medication in treating the mood disorder, in treating chronic pain, and this we're in the process of changing.
Yes.
And one way is with this medicine buprenorphine, which can be used without stimulating addiction in patients with chronic pain. Mm-hmm. All opiates can be used thoughtfully without directly stimulating addiction, but buprenorphine can be actually used more effectively at times, and some patients on chronic opiates can become somewhat depressed from the opiate effect, can become de-energized, and this can be dealt with buprenorphine. And buprenorphine can also be given, and over time you need less buprenorphine rather than more like other opiates. So that's why it's so valuable. It's used in Europe as a transdermal patch. We don't have that here yet.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to read the tea leaves of what the priority of the drug companies and the FDA are. There seems to be very little public policy-driven changes in the system, with a few exceptions. That one exception being that buprenorphine was brought to the treatment of addicts to some degree by the National Institute of Drug Abuse, to their credit.
So is it being used more then to help addicts move off of opiates than it is to help people suffering from chronic pain?
Yes, it's not approved in the United States directly for chronic pain. So there's a great vacuum of real direction to the medical community. We need to get buprenorphine in forms and dosages that are directly approved for pain.
Now, do you have access to those forms and dosages at your in your program?
Yes, we create them ourselves out of either the other forms by maybe dividing the pills up, or we have it specially compounded, you know, by compounding pharmacists. It's all completely allowable and legal and good medical practice, but the commercial regulatory system has not yet created a form of buprenorphine in the U.S. which is directly FDA-approved for chronic pain, which is a shame. And I think will be changing, but in the meantime, doctors who become familiar with this field can use buprenorphine in different forms, and we call it off-label use, but it's use that is documented and studied by thousands of papers, you know, that have been published worldwide since buprenorphine's invention, you know, in the 1970s. So at our program, Recovery Without Walls, we often get patients with a chronic pain condition, people that have who've started to develop mood disorder or addictive disorder or thinking disorder, and using buprenorphine and other medications, as well as nutritional supplements, as well as good psychotherapy, as well as exercise and body therapies, we've had a lot of success in helping people who often thought and whose families thought that that there was no future for them.
Right, and I know that in a conversation you mentioned that your model is designed around the patient. So many programs are the patient kind of is made to fit into the model. So just to be clear to people who are listening, if people are interested in your program, Recovery Without Walls, there is a residential component, but that component is there to help fit them and to make their recovery in whatever area they're working on really work for them. Is that right?
Technically, what we do is we consider it an intensive outpatient program, and we treat people in their own home or in a hotel nearby, which becomes their home while they're with us. And we give them a one-on-one care provider, and that person can detoxify them with the physician and the nurse in constant communication through very rough detoxes, but very individualized so that they're not suffering needlessly. Often people have been made to detox and sort of kick very hard and go through very strenuous experiences, which in our opinion are not only not necessary, but they're harmful because these are people who are already traumatized, often by events in their life or by the disease that they're suffering from, so that they really need to be handled gently. And we try to do that.
And I guess I'd like to make the point, too, that you're working with both and. There are people with chronic pain who are not necessarily addicts,
right,
but need help with their chronic pain. You work with those folks. You also work with people who have become addicted for whatever reason. I mean, they may have become addicted through having been prescribed medication for chronic pain. They may have become addicted just through experimentation, and you do have a program particularly oriented towards teens, don't you, called Beat Your Addictions?
Yes. You know, two things have contributed to young people getting more involved with opiates. One is during the late 1990s, there was a resurgence of inexpensive heroin, you know, in the United States, and there developed a style called heroin chic, you know, which a lot of the young people emulated. This was kind of skinny models, you know, who were popularized at that time. And then in the 2000s, in the first decade of this century, what we've had is a resurgence of young people being very interested in prescription drug opiates. You know?
And they're definitely out there in everybody's medicine cabinet, aren't there?
Yeah, they're in the cabinets, and the young people see pills advertised on television, like sleeping pills. So they feel that pills must be cool, pills must be safe, you know,
and not dangerous.
Right, right.
Yeah. So we need to take a break, but let's come back to this discussion about teens and prescription drug use when we come back.
Thank you.
Why have we come to Earth? Do you remember? Why have we taken Earth? Why have we come?
Hello, this is Diane Pendola, and you are listening to The Lioness Tale, Awakening the Liberating Spirit. And we're talking with Dr. Kornfeld today, and we were just discussing about teen opiate use and how easy it is for teens to get prescribed drugs from their parents' medicine cabinet, and how it feels safe to use these kind of drugs. As far as they're concerned, they don't realize the dangers involved.
Yes, and we've been seeing a lot more teens, often senior year in high school, first year in college, that that do become dependent on the opiate drugs. And it turns out that although they're young, that they really need help like older folks do that also have become dependent. And so they respond very, very nicely to buprenorphine.
Uh-huh.
Studies have been done showing this, and studies have been done showing that sometimes giving them the buprenorphine for a longer period of time safeguards them against relapse or overdose, and that they need to be gradually strengthened so that they could become opiate and medication free, but it sometimes can't happen overnight.
And I think I also remember from a conversation with you that you know, teens are interested, they're curious, they're experimenting with drugs, but the teens that tend to get addicted are the ones who do have underlying anxiety, depression, and they find that taking these drugs is relieving an underlying pain, huh?
Absolutely.
That they weren't even aware of, probably.
Yeah, absolutely. Opiates have that capacity to sort of dissolve traumatic pain, emotional pain,
mm-hmm.
and once they discover that that happens, they could often take the opiates and function very well
mm-hmm.
for months and months. Sometimes they excel in school during the first phase of their addiction, so that it doesn't become evident until later on when their use escalates and they start to have dysfunction in their life,
and then
they could rapidly go downhill.
Right. So socially, we need to make some big changes, don't we, to begin to maybe shift this war on drugs, which becomes war on our children, war on our friends, war on our family members, war on chronic pain sufferers, to something else. What direction do you think we should move as a society in
well,
these areas?
I think we've all been like that lioness, you know, in terms of drugs and substances and medications. We've all been imprisoned by our ignorance, by our misunderstanding of the role of drugs and addiction. And a lot of changes are needed. I've been encouraged by the fact that the current White House National Drug Control Office, which has been called the Drug Czar, which I think that term is being used less and less, fortunately, they've also said, we're ready to move on from this term war on drugs. We're ready to see this as a public health problem, like many countries in Europe have been doing for the last several decades. And so we do have some sense that changes are afoot to stop the massive imprisonment of drug users and even low-level drug dealers
mm-hmm.
That really have packed our prisons.
Yes.
And seem to be recognizing now that the marijuana plant, the cannabis plant, has great medicinal value, being recognized in a dozen or more states. And I think gradually there's a realization that that people have the right to use marijuana if they choose to do so responsibly, just as they can drink alcohol. So I think this will result in a major shift from a heavy law enforcement, criminal justice driven system that informs how we treat pain, how we treat addiction, to one that it's more medical, that's more sociological, that's more non-ideological, that's more based on evidence.
And that's more compassionate.
More compassionate.
Yes, absolutely. Well, we just have a couple minutes left, and I really want to give you an opportunity to give your website and let people know how they can contact you or any other information you'd like to give.
Sure. Well, our website is recoverywithoutwalls.com. And my name, again, is Howard Kornfeld, and I'm the medical director, but we have a whole team of psychotherapists and nurse practitioners and massage therapists and acupuncturists and yoga teachers.
Wonderful.
And
what a wonderful model. I hope it just takes, it just starts to create a domino effect across the country.
Yeah, that's what we're hoping for. And I think the Recovery Without Walls model could be a model that would eventually be paid for by insurance. Unfortunately, it is not at the current time. Because I think the individual attention is what's sometimes missing when people go to the so-called residential rehab programs, because it's been proven that most people who go relapse.
Yes.
And often in a catastrophic way. So with greater attention to the individual need and a less ideologic and more scientific and compassionate program, people with addictions and pain can really have their life given back to them.
Well, thank you so much for being on our show today. I just really know that this is going to go out and touch a lot of people's lives and really could be transformative for many people. So thank you for taking your time to be with us.
Thank you very much.
All right. So thank you, everybody, for listening. Next week, we will be welcoming Dr. Vincent Felitti, who is one of the co-principals in the ACE study, Adverse Childhood Experiences and Their Effect on Adult Life. So I hope you will listen next week. And please go to our website, thelionesstale.com, to buy our book and to see more about our work in the prisons. Thank you for listening. See you next week.
Author of The Lioness Tale, minister and Enneagram teacher Diane Pendola is the director and co-founder of Skyline Harvest, an eco-contemplative center in the Sierra foothills of Northern California. Living on 200 private acres with wooded trails and spectacular views, she offers Lioness Tale workshops, Enneagram consultations, and retreat opportunities. Diane created and conducts an in-prison transformational program called the Lioness Tale Prison Project. At Skyline Harvest, as well as inside prison walls, she advances the theme of her Voice America radio show, The Lioness Tale, Awakening the Liberating Spirit. If you are interested in sponsoring this life-changing program for people inside prison, or if you wish to purchase Diane's book, schedule a consultation, retreat, or workshop at Skyline Harvest, contact Diane at www.ecocontemplative.org or call 530-288-0308. Again, that's ecocontemplative.org or call 530-288-0308.